Thank you very much. I wanted to start off tonight by, give me a little slack here, how the Battle of Drainesville Civil War Trails sign was erected in 2006, I believe. And in 2005, and I always give credit to the round table, because I had walked out after a meeting, and I was walking in the parking lot, and a gentleman who knew I was writing signs at that time came up to me and said, "You know, I had an ancestor who fought with the Pennsylvania Bucktails," and I said, "Well, I don't know much about them, and I don't really know much about the Battle of Drainesville. I was kind of a newbie after a couple of years, but it's amazing how much local history we have here." And one thing led to another, and I had a connection in Fairfax County by Mr. Rob Orson, who had just become the site manager at Sully Plantation, right up the road here. And I'd met him through Mitch Bowman, the executive director, to help him write the Sully sign. So one thing led to another, and we got the sign erected. And like I said, a lot of things happen here. And my point is that a lot of things happen here at the Bull Run Civil War Roundtable, and a lot of ideas, a lot of things are happening. So let's get started here. So we can hit those lights there. Okay. All right. All right. This is the little town of Bethlehem. Now, this little town of Drainesville is what's unique about this map here is that the Drainesville is misspelled. But and the reason I liked it to start off on this lecture is the fact that it's a very insignificant battle. Some wouldn't even call it a battle. Some would have called it an action or a skirmish. But it does have a lot of unique qualities and capabilities, in the sense that it was a battle that a lot of things happened in 1861, and I will explain that to you later. But the main thing is I want to also explain about the area and how this battle had come to pass. There's the Civil War Trail sign that's at the tavern at Drainesville off of Route 7. The tavern's only moved 125 feet, I believe, and they moved the whole thing back from the highway. But as you can see right here, there's a little tiny battle map right there, and we are, that Drainesville Tavern is about a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles down the road from where the battle actually was fought. But it was one of the better places to put it, so we decided to put it there. Okay, there's the Drainesville Tavern today, and I believe you can still hold meetings and things there, so it's right off of Route 7. Okay, one of the biggest reasons, and I felt, doing a lot of research on this Battle of Drainesville, was the fact that the blockade of the Potomac after First Manassas was a huge reason why shipping and products were stopped moving up the Potomac and reinforcing Washington. This had a lot to play with this battle, as we'll go forward here. The Confederates put the 37 cannon along four or five different forts at Evansport, at Shippingsport, at Freestone Point, and at Cockpit Point, and it was almost like a gauntlet that you would have to go up to get any type of provisions and food up to Washington. Remember at that time that Washington had at least 100, maybe 75 to 100,000 troops in the area, and about 30 to 40,000 people living there, so that was a lot of people to feed and a lot of people to get provisions to. So because of the blockade and having to run this gauntlet, most of the shipping went up the Chesapeake Bay to Baltimore and took slow rail and a lot of problems trying to get it back down from Baltimore down into Washington. So there was a statement for 5 months that everyone in Washington suffered from just lack of different things, and especially possibly food. But this will definitely cause a problem to the surrounding armies that are camped there. Now, this is Williams Ordinary in Dumfries. This is the headquarters of the Prince William County Historical Preservation Group, who have taken over, use it as their offices. But this was the headquarters of General William H.C. Whiting, who commanded the Confederate forces for the blockade. So this was his headquarters. We're trying to do preservation on this, and eventually I'd like to see it turn into a very nice restaurant, but you know, one of those historical restaurants. But that's in the future. This is a great location right on Route 1 in Dumfries. But of course, as we talked about, as Nancy mentioned about the brochure, we had a Dumfries sign made up, and here's Whiting right down here. And it's talked about exactly what happened in Dumfries. And there are some shell fragments and bullets and, I believe, a cannonball possibly still stuck in Williams Ordinary when Jeb Stuart bombarded Dumfries in December of 1862 on his famous Christmas raid. So it's a very, it's an excellent place to visit and part of the Prince William County Civil War Trail. Okay, here's a picture from a gentleman by the name of Sneeden, of course. He had many books, but he did a picture of Shipping Point. This is at on the Quantico base. It was his interpretation. Looks pretty narrow there. I call it the guns of Navarone, pretty much, but 37 guns in different locations. I don't think I would want to take my ship through there. And it was the Federals were on the other side of the river, and they were basically down there in the Indian Head area where I actually work, and but not a lot of shipping was happening there, and there was an occasional battle between a flotilla ship and the battery. Historians mention that there were over 5,000 shots fired during the blockade. The damage inflicted on different shipping was very minimal in some respects, but it was the psychological as I was pointing out about, that just kept that river pretty much shut down. This is a picture from Harper's Weekly of Cockpit Point in the foreground. It's Possum Nose is what is in front of it. We possibly will be taking a Civil War Bull Run Civil War roundtable tour of that if we can get up to that facility. And there are a lot of Potomac River, Prince William County is running a lot of Potomac River trips up and down the river, tours and things like that. That's just to start to open up too. I'd love to take that if I really could. This is Bud's Creek, and this is on the Federal side, and there were actually some cannon there too, and they used to shoot at each other every once in a while, but I don't know if they were actually hitting each other. But the main thing is that the Federals were on the Maryland side, and there was actually, at one time, they were being commanded by a famous, later a famous general by the name of Joseph Hooker, was actually.
Mark, where up and down the river is it? Are we, is it north of Washington, south?
South, yes, ma'am. Very I'll try to show a little tiny map here. It's not the greatest in the world, but. Okay, here, we'll talk next about the winter camps. The winter camps. After the Battle of First Manassas, the Confederates decided to stage camps from all the way up to the Bull Run Mountains here, all the way down to the Potomac, and all along the Bull Run River. And that was kind of the DMZ. And these camps, the largest of the camps, of course, was here at Centerville, where they actually brought up a railroad line from the junction later to supply the camp. And the camps, well, I don't know, I could describe, well, a gentleman was telling me the other day how to describe what it was like to live in these camps in the wintertime, and it was kind of like, he says, if you were ever interested in reading a book on Stalingrad, then go stand out in a blizzard and read the book while you read, you know, that's kind of the effect. I mean, it's just unbelievable, tough living conditions at that time. Now, here's the famous Civil War picture of Centerville. As you see, they cut down all the trees around Centerville. There wasn't a tree to be found, mostly for firewood and camp. So what they would have to do is they'd have to send parties out to go collect the firewood and also to collect forage. Forage, of course, is for the horses and things along those lines. And a cavalry horse, on the average, this is an amazing thought, has to eat at least 15 to 25 pounds of food a day, or we begin to starve. And I don't know how many horses were starving, but I know in 1863, Stuart lost like half of his horses in just in that case. In the South, I understood that a lot of the people that were in the cavalry would bring their own horses with them to the cavalry, where the Federals later on were manufacturing horses out west in camps and sending them in. So as attrition was, the Federals always had a lot more fresher horses than the Confederates. But as you can see here, this is what Centerville looked like. Probably where we are right now, as far as I know. Yes, ma'am.
Urban sprawl.
Right. Here's some Texas guys down in the Neabsco Creek area in Prince William County. The Texas Brigade was quartered down there. As you can see, it looks like the ground is pretty much just solid mud or everything else. And that's what happened when you lose trees and you start building around things. It just turns into mud. You're not going to have a lot of grass. Of course, you're going to be dirty, and disease is going to set in. And that's the biggest thing I could talk about in the Civil War is the sense that more people died of disease than anything else. And I found this next. Of course, this is the sign here that Rob and I put in a couple of years ago. And I just wanted to point out there is a little, if you go see this sign in the Neabsco Creek area, and it's also online, there's the Potomac River, and there's where all the forts are on both sides of the river. And we were able to get that map on there. And, of course, the picture I just showed you is right there. So it's good that for as I always say, is when I'm long gone, these signs will be there for people to see how things really were in that at that time. And I made sure that different things were put on the sign. At least this was, we can read this, is our losses in the winter of 1861 from sickness and exposure incident to Campbell Lake were very heavy. I had the measles. I think more people died of the measles around here. I know in the Haymarket area and different areas they have on both sides of St. Paul's Church in Haymarket, bodies are buried or were buried there of people who just died of disease, mostly measles from the Alabama brigades and different things like that. It's typhoid, pneumonia. And for 10 or 12 days, I did not eat a mouthful of anything. Can you imagine that? I can't imagine not eating anything for a day, much less 10 or 12 days. But then again, that's my problem. Okay. Oops. Here's another one I wanted to. One of our company died last Saturday. John Massey at the hospital with typhoid fever. Those hospitals are just like slaughter pens. Half or nearly. So they go there, either die or fit or nothing if they get well. I should go to one. I would despair of ever leaving it alive. I never will go to one if I can help it. And that was from the 13th Mississippi. So I could just imagine what these people were going through. Real short story. I remember that Mosby asked Stuart in after the Christmas raid in Haymarket not to go into winter camp. He wanted to get his partisan Rangers. He asked for 9 of the 1st Virginia to go out and to start his partisan activities, and I can understand why. I don't think, you know, going into these camps in the winter, the chances are you not coming out were pretty good. Of course, there were stories at Fredericksburg where General Lee, he was usually in a tent at outside of Fredericksburg after the Battle of Fredericksburg, but he got very sick, and he had the fever for a long, long time. So we always asked him, people would ask him, why don't you take over one of these nice houses and get out of the tent, generally? And he said, no, I wanted to stay there. Of course, they were always giving Jackson a hard time because he was actually inside of a house at the Moss Point, down in Fredericksburg. And of course, Lee wasn't. So anyway, very tough winter. Federal camps. Camp Pierpont, that was the camp where we will be discussing tonight over the fact that the Pennsylvania Brigade that fought at Drainsville came out of. Of course, they cut down trees and dismantled fences. the Union troops, in a nutshell, they confiscated cattle along with everything else. And that's what happened. I mean, they just took this, the troops were just taking everything. And, of course, the blockade down there was keeping a lot of the food and a lot of the necessities up. So things just started to happen. And what the food and all the different things that they were lacking, they had to go out with forage parties, and they had to go out and start looking around they had to go further out, maybe many miles, to bring some of this stuff back. Here's another picture. This is actually Camp Pierrepont near Langley, Virginia, which where most of those Pennsylvania troops were. Oops. And there's a more of a landscape. As you can see, most of those trees are down. It looks pretty muddy to me. And there's only along a ridge line of trees up there. They'll probably cut those down soon enough. So this camp was in operation all the way down into March of 1862. Everybody knows in March of 1862, these camps broke up. Everybody headed down to Richmond. It's the Southern troops headed down to Richmond to stop the 100,000 of McClellan coming up from the peninsula. And, of course, the Federals took over their camps and moved in to their different areas. So this camp was in operation for 6 to 8 months. And at least over 100 young men died there of disease. And I know that their bodies in 1866, Arlington Cemetery, this is from Fairfax County records, I believe Arlington Cemetery got those. They took those bodies out and interred them in Arlington in 1866. So, this is a little house here. Should be called Bienvenue, but it's called Benvenue. It's in that area. People are living there, but it is a historic place. A little on Benvenue. It was part of an estate called Woodbury by Lord Fairfax in 1724. It was granted to George Turbeville. No relation, but Charles Lee Corbin, he had 400 acres in 1796, and a captain bought the place named Thomas Cadsby Jones of the Navy, who had fought in the New Orleans area, and he named it Benvenue, of course, which means Bienvenue, which means welcome in French. And, of course, it was used as a field hospital for those Camp Pierrepont people. Oops. And there's the front section of the house. Okay, conditions at Camp Pierrepont: cramped quarters, breeding ground of disease. Talked about that. Someone was mentioning a dinner tonight, not a very good dinner subject, but we did talk about disease and some of the things. One was water-related problems, and they just didn't know possibly about boiling water, and certainly didn't have any medicine to counter all the different dysentery and all the different things like that. It's difficult to imagine the stream of sick young men who suffered at Benvenue during winter camp. Close to 100 dead from disease were moved to Arlington Cemetery. All right. I always wondered why a foraging party would end up at Drainsville and they were actually fighting there. I always wondered how that battle always came about. And this battle, which will, thanks to the Fairfax County 150th Sesquicentennial Committee, will be placing a sign at Lewinsville in the McLean area. Lewinsville was actually a foraging party. And who was at Lewinsville? Was with 300 men at that time, was Jeb Stuart. And, of course, Baldy Smith had 2,000 soldiers. They went into Lewinsville. And the man in charge there, I believe, was, we'll talk about him, is Isaac from Ox Hill.
Stevens?
Thank you, Isaac. And he's there, and he's got 2,000 men. They're foraging and trying to get what they need. And Stuart comes in with 300 and 2 cannon from the Washington Artillery, and it was actually shooting at Blackburn Fort. And he attacks and actually drives in an artillery battle. They both leave, but basically he did hold his own and did drive some of the Yankees back and made them retreat. So they called it pretty reckless, but from this, Stewart did get some acclaim, and that was enough to push him over to become a brigadier general at that time. At this time, during Louisville, he was a colonel. So this is it's finally dawning on me that foraging parties are getting bigger and bigger, and it's funny that at Drainesville, there's 3,000 Federals going to Drainesville, and they left another 3,000 back in reserve, and this time Stewart is not taking 300 people. He's taking 1,800 people with him to go on these foraging parties. So they're getting bigger and bigger. But then again, they may need more supplies. Here's a picture from Harper's Weekly of some Union officers saluting some of the wounded and possibly some of the dead at the Louisville action. I'm really happy that there will be a Civil War Trail sign, one of many that Fairfax County will be putting up in the next couple of years. There's Stevens and the 79th Highlander. As you can see, that was the same. This guy looks like he just came off the boat from Scotland, but he's part of those. And Stevens, of course, you'll hear a lot about him. I'm really getting to know this guy, and he's like a local hero to me in that sense. I love a lot of our Confederate heroes, but then our federal heroes too. And Stevens, of course, died. And in the movie, he was wrapped around the flag at Ox Hill, but he did die at Ox Hill, and he's buried. He's not buried there, but his marker's there along with Kearney, who Kearney, of course, was, they called him one of the bravest of the brave. So Ox Hill is a very big anniversary for us to come to go see. But there's a picture of Stevens. Of course, as you can see, they all die way too young in this terrible battle. Okay, let's get into the Battle of Drainesville, the federal units. All right, this is General George Archibald McCall. He is in charge of all of the Pennsylvania units at that time. And give you a little background on all of these guys. He was born in Philadelphia in 1802, so he's actually 59 years old at the time of the battle. A graduate of West Point and fought in the Seminole Wars down in Florida and the Mexican-American War, and was at Gallantry at Palo Alto, and retired after 31 years of service in 1853. So he'd been retired for 8 years before the war came out. But in the beginning of the war, he organized some Pennsylvania volunteers as a major general in May of 1861, and at this time was leading the 4th Corps, I believe, at in the area, and he was one of the oldest West Point graduates to serve in the war. Now, he did not go to Drainesville, but he did send this man, General Edward Otho Cressap Ord, who, I like that picture, he looks very relaxed. There's a couple other pictures, but I wanted this picture. He has quite a unique, this guy, just reading all the things he did, he just did a tremendous amount of things during the war, before the war, and after the war. But he was born in Cumberland, Maryland, and was the second. His father was in the War of 1812, but he graduated from West Point in 1835. As a second lieutenant, he was in the Seminole Wars down in Florida also, and also fought in the Mexican War in 1848. I'll take my glasses off so I can see. As a young lieutenant, he was placed in charge of the Monterey garrison, and he spent a lot of time in California. And of course, everybody knows there's a Fort Ord in California, and it's named after him. So he did a lot. He had a lot of influence in the California area. But at this time, he's in. Of course, he married a California girl named Mary Mercer Thompson in 1854 from San Francisco. So 1859, he made his way back east and was involved with an artillery school at Fort Monroe. And later in 1861, he became a brigadier general and, of course, of these volunteers from Pennsylvania. And here's a breakdown of his command. The 1st Pennsylvania Rifles are your bucktails. Your 6th Pennsylvania, 9th, 10th, 12th, the Battery A under Hezekiah Easton and two companies of cavalry. So 3,100 men are in the Drainesville area in the morning of on December 20th, 1861. There's about another 3,000 men under a general by the name of Reynolds, the famous Buford going, there's going to be hell to pay if Reynolds doesn't get up here at Gettysburg. Well, he's sitting in a place called Difficult Run, which is down maybe a couple miles to the west of Drainesville, to the east of Drainesville, and he's there in reserve. All right, now this is a really interesting gentleman named Thomas Kane. He's of the Bucktails, and he's an American attorney and an abolitionist, and he got involved in Philadelphia area with the Church of the Latter-day Saints, and he became a constant member of them and got to know Brigham Young, and one thing led to another, and of course the Mormons did move out to Utah. And after the war, Kane did stay in contact with them, and they actually have a statue of him out there, and they actually named a county in Utah after him. And on the statue at the Utah Capitol building, it says about Kane, he was a friend of the Mormons. So I'm not sure if he ever became a Mormon, but he would do a lot of legal litigation for them, and he did a lot of things for the Mormons, and I just thought that was really unique, especially now. It was this presidential election comes into play here, but he does form the Bucktails, and which came out of an area around McKean County, Pennsylvania. The way they got the name Bucktails Brigade was there was a young lad by the name of James Londergren who signed up to be with the 1st Pennsylvania Reserve, and he ran across the street at a muster and cut off a tail of a deer and stuck it on his cap. And that became, Kane looked at that and said, I think we'll just call all these guys Bucktails. So everybody in the unit had a piece of deer on their cap. And everybody in Pennsylvania, you know guys from Pennsylvania, like it's like deer hunter. I mean, if you're from Pennsylvania and haven't hunted deer, I don't know what's wrong with you. I'm just kidding. So they're the first. Now, he was not in charge of it initially. Charles Biddle was named as the colonel, but Kane was the lieutenant colonel, so he was second in command. You can't see them very well, but here's a picture of them from the internet. But this is what I found you need to go out to Bucktails, is Kane teaches these guys not to fight out in the open, not to fight in Napoleonic formation, but to utilize as much of the your surrounding area as you can and take cover. So there's your Bucktails coming right at you behind a fence. So this is typical of them. Of course, in Drainesville, they were in a house and some other areas, but this is a good picture of them in formation and opening fire behind a fence. So that's the one thing Kane was trying to teach them. And the Bucktails on their hat, and most of them are very good shots because they kill a lot of deer, so they're just... Of course, there's a model. There's a picture of a Bucktail there. Of course, you can see on his hat. And there's a real live Bucktail. And there's another one from the internet, courtesy of your internet, which has wonderful pictures. All right, the 9th Pennsylvania was a gentleman by the name of Conrad Fegger Jackson. We could talk about Jackson all day, but this is the federal Jackson, not Stonewall Jackson. So just Jackson was born in Pennsylvania, of course. Worked a lot on the railroads and of course was in the Mexican-American War, and he formed some militia in the Pennsylvania area and was the commander of the 9th. I tried to get as many of the Pennsylvania guys as I could possibly get, of their commanders that I could find. Here's another one of the 10th Reserves, Colonel John S. McCalmont. This gentleman was before the war, was an attorney, and then he go to West Point, but he was like a professional, he was a politician in Pennsylvania throughout the 40s and the 50s. So When the war broke out, he became a colonel of the 10th Pennsylvania Reserve. This is a real good guy here that really did a tremendous amount at Drainesville. And of course he went down and fought at Gaines Mill, and he was killed at Gaines Mill. And one of the things that they had said was the fact that that when the Southern troops asked him to surrender, and he said, "No, I'll never surrender," and the next volley killed him. So he died never surrendering, but he was a really he had a tremendous influence on the Battle of Gainesville. He was from Pennsylvania also. Two others that I don't have pictures of that were the 6th Pennsylvania, named Lieutenant Colonel Penrose, who in 1862, he left the war, resigned his commission, and became a part owner of a cemetery in Pennsylvania. And then there was a Colonel Taggart who, after 7 days in the summer of 1862, he resigned his commission also. He was of the 12th Pennsylvania. All right, the Confederate units. All right, who's that? Okay, everybody knows. Everybody knows that's Stuart, right? Well, if you didn't know, that's Jeb Stuart, as a young man without his beard. Now, my children saw me without my beard one time, and I remember my youngest daughter was crying, "Where's my daddy?" You know, so my sister-in-law opened the door one time, and she I knocked on the door, and she said, "Can I help you, sir?" And I was like, "Yeah." So that is Jeb Stuart. There he is. That's Jeb Stuart, as we said, at Lewinsville. He's now a brigadier general, and he's in this area. He's a Camp QV in near Fairfax. He's already met Antonio Ford and Laura Ratcliffe. We can go on and on about that, and there's been lectures, but he's quite the character. And he is sent out, and this time he doesn't take 300 men. He takes 1,800 men with him, which I could see that these are becoming more and more big military exercises. And Drainesville was an area that was not been looked at that, you know, at least for foraging at that time. All right, he takes 1,200 men with him. I thought it was 1,800, but it's 1,200 with the 10th Alabama, the 1st Kentucky, the 6th South Carolina, 11th Virginia, the Sumter Flying Artillery, and the 2nd and 1st North Carolina Cavalry units. So, and of course, large wagon trains full of empty wagons that they would hope to collect as much forage as they could. This is Colonel Taylor of the 1st Kentucky. Hadn't heard much about the 1st Kentucky. I was they ended up joining up with General Johnston up in the valley right before 1st Manassas, but they never made their way to 1st Manassas, so they were not they had not seen the elephant, as they say. They had not been in battle yet. As Thomas Taylor is the colonel of the Kentucky, they they're in camp for the first time, and they're given, as he writes, they were given 40 rounds of ammunition and 2 days of ration, and they were to report to Jeb Stuart headquarters on this march. So this is basically their first action. Of course, here's their battle flag, which I thought was really nice. So that was given to them in December of 1861. So they probably carried that with them up to Drainesville. Here's John Horace Forney of the 10th Alabama. Now, the 10th Alabama had fought at 1st Manassas. And a little background on him. He was from Alabama. And subsequently, it was according to, I'll get into that later. He's later on in life, of course, he was went out to Texas and fought out there. And he became a general. And he also had another brother named William, who was also a Confederate general. So two Forneys were general during the war. Here's Garland. Now, Garland is near and dear to me in the sense that he was with the 11th Virginia that fought along the line on the Bull Run River at Blackburn Ford. So they had seen the elephant, and he was very gallant and did a good job at Blackburn Ford. This young man unfortunately dies South Mountain, in September of 1862. And General Lee eulogized Garland, said he was a brave and accomplished young officer. And D.A. General D.A. Chill called Garland the most fearless man I ever knew. So he was quite a character. And the 11th Virginia was pretty much formed in the Lynchburg area. And here's a picture of a Lynchburg rifles. This is where Garland trained and brought those boys to the First Manassas Battle. So the 6th South Carolina, I didn't know much about them. I knew a lot about the 5th South Carolina because they fought at Grigsby's Hill down here during the First Battle of Manassas. But here's their flag. They're commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Seacrest, right, and they're another unit that's never been in action before, and they had gotten to Manassas after the battle, and they were in camp, of course, and of course in camp, what most of these people do in camp is they stand picket duty and stuff like that, but they did go on throughout the war and fought many major battles and ended up fighting all the way down with the Army of Northern Virginia as we got toward Petersburg in 1864. So, of course, didn't have a lot on Lieutenant Colonel Seacrest because I believe that after this, a couple months later, he resigned his commission. Here's 1st North Carolina Cavalry, North Carolina Cavalry. And here's Captain Pitzer of the 2nd Virginia Cavalry and what they look like. That's what their soldiers and cavalry troopers look like. Pitzer did a lot of good work at Drainesville, and we'll get into that a little later. Here's Colonel Cutts later in life. He's the commander of the Sumter Artillery. I'm sorry, I got a P in there. So I'll have to take that out. The Sumter Flying Artillery, they call themselves. There's their flag. And here's a picture of what it was like to take these caissons and these cannon along these muddy roads in the winter to get, and of course, I'm saying there's a good picture of them taking their cannon up to the Drainesville area. All right, let's start on the Battle of Drainesville and why we're here. So we've set the stage. Everybody's sick, everybody's hungry, and everybody's cold. Everybody needs food, and the horses need food. So both armies on the 20th, they leave for a foraging expedition, and the Federals make it to Drainesville first. And, of course, their Pitzer, who I just talked about, he had actually had some cavalry up there in reconnaissance, so Jeb Stuart wasn't very far behind. Of course, the cavalry always goes ahead to scout and check out the area. Well, of course, seeing Ord's troops coming down the road, Pitzer scatters, but immediately scatters south and heads down Reston Parkway. And that's exactly where we're talking about, where Reston Parkway hits 7 is our battlefield at this time. So he's heading down, and he's going to warn Stuart that the Federals are in Drainesville. Here's a map that has everyone kind of laid out across the field. But here's your 1st Pennsylvania Bucktails in a place called the Thornton House. They're inside the Thornton House and outside of it. And they've set up there. Easton Battery is right here. Ord did take the high ground. It was very important. He's got 6 guns up there, Ezekiah, Easton. And he's got the high ground. This is looking south. So this is the Reston Parkway coming up. Drainesville Town's over here. And Sumter Artillery sets up right in here. And, of course, the battle starts. And the battle starts basically when Cutts is the Sumter Artillery opens up with 4 guns, I think it was 5 guns possibly, and opens up the action. And immediately Easton Battery sends 3 volleys of shots down toward the Cutts Artillery and literally destroys the whole battery even before they could get their second shot off. So it was just they lost five men and 16 wounded at that time, and they saved one cannon. So right off the start of this battle, your Confederate artillery that would help support was already disabled. So Stuart, he's got his divisions. At this time, they're all coming up the road. Cutts' artillery has been pretty much disabled, as I was saying. So he breaks off into this woods. This is a very good view of the fact that he sends the 1st Kentucky and the 6th South Carolina to the left off the road, and he sends the 10th Alabama and the 11th Virginia behind them off the road, and they're all in this heavy thicket. We talked about thicket in the wintertime, but it was trees and forest. And there's some pictures that will go on, and you'll see how open everybody looks in the field, but a lot of this fighting was done inside very thick woods. And there was a case at this time that the 1st Kentucky, as the 6th South Carolina, moved up into position against the 9th Pennsylvania, who was sent over to defend the right side of the federal line. The 1st Kentucky mistook the 6th South Carolina and opened fire on them and killed five of them, according to Dr. Charles Poland in his book. So it's a friendly fire incident. Some of this has gotten back to Stuart, and he had to go up there, and he also sent some other people, tried to get these people organized. And eventually, the 1st Kentucky were face-to-face in between some trees with the 9th Pennsylvania. Now, it's interesting that there's many stories on this also about how people were hearing people saying things down the line. Now, the colonel of the Pennsylvania unit did not open fire initially on the Kentucky unit because he wasn't exactly sure who they were. And somebody called out from the Pennsylvania line, "Are you Bucktails?" And they said, "Yes, we are." Yeah, so and then somebody said, "For God's sakes, don't shoot." And it's just this kind of communication back and forth and not really being able to see one another, that the 6th South Carolina took a little advantage of that and opened fire on the 1st Kentucky. And, of course, then they returned fire. And eventually, with the help of the Bucktails and also this 12th Pennsylvania Reserve, they drove the 1st Kentucky and the 6th South Carolina back. There was a lot of movement in that woods for the next 2 hours. And Taylor, who was the colonel of the 1st Kentucky, he got disoriented, lost his people, and by nightfall he had to do a little low crawling there and had to hide out until after everybody left, and he eventually made his way back. So that's how disoriented it was in those woods for those troops. Now, as you can see here, they do have some trees over here, but this is, you know, these are Civil War pictures. This is Easton's battery blowing up Cutts' artillery down here. But as you can see, there's all these troops out in the open and fighting. This is not the Battle of Drainesville. I mean, in retrospect, it was done a lot in the woods. And this is a picture that's more like it. I mean, here's your Bucktails and low crawling and on their knees shooting. And here's all this heavy woods and everything back here. And that's probably your 1st Kentucky and your Pennsylvania units, and of course your South Carolina units in the woods fighting. So this is a little bit more like what was seen. And of course, there's the Reston Parkway as you're looking south. Looks like you need a little VDOT work there, I guess. Okay. Now, this is a little better picture. The 11th Virginia and the 10th Alabama later got into the game, and Forney attacked right in front of the Bucktails, and there was a little bit of support also from the 6th Pennsylvania, who moved over to the other side over here, and the 10th Pennsylvania was in reserve, never did get much into the fighting, but did shoot at the enemy from their position. And the 10th Alabama, through the woods, had a real hard time of it also. Forney was wounded. They lost their command. A Major Woodward came second in command. He was wounded, and they eventually retreated. And the 11th Virginia on the far right of the Confederate line did get into it also, but they were under heavy fire. All the units that were in the open that they could see, Eastern Battery was just pounding them with canister and everything else. So it was very rough on the Confederates at that time. They had no artillery to combat that. So, and of course, Stuart, seeing and hearing what was going on, decided that this is just not worth it. And of course, the cavalry is coming back to him saying, "Sir, we've been over to the far right, and we've seen units moving up of Reynolds, who is in reserve. He's coming up the road." And he said, when they come into play, this could become a huge rout." So Stuart leaves the field, and the Federals are victorious, because if you leave the field in the Civil War, you've won the day. Stuart doesn't see it that way, but that's one of those things. This is looking south toward the lines again. That's Eastern's battery. And of course, I told you that they've got their first baptism of fire at Drainsville. 5 killed, 13 wounded, more than any other battle they fought in. And they fought, there's a great book on them by James Spesher, I guess. And he wrote a book on this, and they fought all the way through the war. But their initial battle was quite a disaster for them. So Stuart retreats to Frying Pan Park. I don't know why there isn't a Civil War trail sign at Frying Pan Park, but I'm sure there will be. But that place was just Civil War. Everything is happening around Frying Pan Park during the war. And that's the church there. So what was interesting was Stuart got the 8th Georgia, and somebody else came up the next day to reinforce them. And Stuart went back to the battlefield and picked up some of his wounded and others. So he actually went back to the battlefield the next day, but Ord and his Pennsylvania troops had moved out. So Stuart might have thought that he had won the day. He was back on the battlefield. They weren't there, but that's just the way it was. Of course, 4 p.m., the entire Confederate force will retreat. Garland was the best of the shape of the Stuart forces, set up a rear guard position. Confederate losses were 43 killed, 143 wounded, and 8 missing. And Ord lost 7 killed and 61 wounded. Ord hauled off 38 wagons full of forage, but more importantly, the battle was a great boost to the morale. And of course, and I'll show you Simon Cameron's face here, but this was a huge, just the first victory in the Northern Virginia area for any Federal troops at this time. After the disaster at First Manassas and Ball's Bluff, they just did not have a victory and wondered if they ever would have a victory. So it did hit the papers. This became a really, this little battle became a very big battle in the sense that the Federals had finally, right before Christmas, had actually had a victory. There was a few victories, quote-unquote victories, out in the Mississippi in the West. Of course, we heard about that last month at the Battle of Belmont, Missouri, which was here. Casualties, 6 killed, 15 wounded of the 11th. 18 killed of the 6th South Carolina 10th. Those were two of the main attacking units in the 1st Kentucky. It was only 1 killed and 23 wounded. They probably were doing a lot of low crawling in around those trees. It was really tough for them. Of course, they really couldn't. I don't know if they really could see. And remember, we always talk about Civil War battles. When the smoke, the cannon, all that starts hitting the area, it's almost impossible to see anything, especially after a couple musket volleys. You're going to have a lot of smoke. Cutt's battery, that's not right. It was 5 killed and 13 wounded. 43 and 143 wounded. Simon Cameron, Secretary of War under Lincoln, and he writes after Drainsville that it was one of the bright spots that gave assurance of the success of coming events, and its effects must be inspired confidence in the belief that thereafter the cause of our country will triumph. So he's already predicting victory after Drainsville. Quite an important battle, as you can see. Forget about Gettysburg, it's Drainsville. We've already won. It was big. It was really big for the Federal cause. Drainsville today, gridlock, just horrible gridlock. There's nothing, this is a great picture, but there's nothing left of the battlefield much at all. There's a couple gas stations and some other things in around the Reston area. And if you ever have gone on Route 7 during rush hour, you could get a great view of the battlefield because you don't go very fast, you don't go very far, so you just sort of crawl along there.
Make
This gentleman's name, Ed Bars, you probably all know him. This is a picture of him leading a tour of the Drainesville area. And as a gentleman came up today, there's a Church of the Brethren up there. And tonight, did I mention it tonight? 20 miles from here, they're doing a Drainesville, Battle of Drainesville lecture in Reston at the same time. So I just think that's fantastic. One of the gentlemen that's at that church is holding that lecture. And I'm really happy that's finally getting, especially on the 150th anniversary, is kind of getting some good publicity. The one thing is, also at the Church of the Brethren, a couple days ago, I understood they had a candlelight vigil, quite moving. So I would love to do that, and I hope to do that in the future if they continue to do that up for the fallen of, and that's what this is all about, everyone. It's hollow ground, and people died there, and they fought there, and of course, the conditions of where they were fighting for and everything, especially just looking for food, is really a tremendous story. Of course, Ed, he always has quite a group around him. I think there's the church right there, and there's Ord at Vicksburg. Later, after his victory at Drainesville, he did head down to the Mississippi and fought around the Vicksburg with U.S. Grant, and they have a statue of him there. Quite a career, I tell you. He, after the war, he goes back out to California. He does more work around the Monterey Bay area and things like that. And of course, they named that fort after him.
Exactly where is Drainesville?
Okay, Drainesville is on Route 7. And near Reston Parkway, and also up Route 28. It's between Reston.
Yeah,
you know, right. I guess if you go all the way up Route 28 to Route 7, and turn right, you'll run right into the tavern there. You'll see the tavern. That they'll call it the Drainesville Tavern, but the battlefield is a little further down from there. Anyway, that's it for the Battle of Drainesville. Thank you very much. I'll entertain some questions at this time. Yes, sir.
Well, this was a little bit after Ball's Bluff, I understand. Yeah. So, were Ord's troops the only Union troops on this side of the river at that time?
No, there's many more camps, Camp Griffin and some others. In the near Washington, and of course, I was telling you there's over 100,000 troops. So the line was basically the forward troops were around the Falls Church area of the Confederates. That's about as far as they got toward Washington, and the Union camps were all over that area. Of course, utilizing the creeks and the rivers and things along those lines for their water. So yeah, they certainly. I think there was close to 80 to 100,000 federal troops in the area at that time. Yes, sir.
Camp Pierpont. And is there a marker there, and where is it exactly? Can you go see anything there?
I'm not sure if there's a marker there. I looked for a marker. I ran in more into that Benvenue, the house that's there in the hospital. I think it definitely needs a marker, and hopefully
Where is Benvenue?
It's in Langley. It's in the Langley area. I don't know. I've never seen it myself. So, yes, sir.
I had the pleasure several years ago of taking part in that candle. They start out with a whole bunch of candles lit. They name the guys.
Oh, do they?
Wow. Pretty well got it. They all know Yank and Red Bull. It's eerie when that light goes out in that church.
Oh, wow. So it goes down to the last light. Wow.
The light of that church. Are you talking about the deep woods?
Yes, sir.
As usual, I have stomped around in there.
Yes. I believe you have.
Rest assured, on the hill across the way, too. I had the occasion to find the earthworks in there, and trenches that to observe myself concluded that's where the bucktails hung their hats, because they come charging up the thing looking about out of hell and got a rude awakening when they come up there.
Mm-hmm.
We found canteen stoppers and everything in those trenches where they still got them.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly came off of some of them Yanks.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I have a very remedial question that could be asked to any person who's standing up there, and that is,
for all the drawings that are done, obviously somebody must be there, and I'm curious who that person is and how quickly are they rendered to you know, for the point of accuracy. Is it all by memory, or do they actually complete it while people are still out there?
Accuracy is, if all these guys are accurate, they'd probably all end up in jail. But yeah, the accuracy of a lot of this is, yes, Mike. Sure.
The two most common ones for the North were Alfred Waddy and Edward Forrest. Both of them traveled with the armies, especially later in the war. I mean, they're the first embedded journalists that really took place in the war. And what I have found is that the soldiers in the action is a farce, but the, pretty much. It's got some historical accuracy. Call it very, 5%. But the land is almost spot on. So if you look at the terrain that these guys are drawing, it's accurate. You can go there and look and see that today down in Culpeper and Fauquier County, where I hang out mostly. The work that they did, it looks just like it did in 1860.
And is it fair to say, unless they were running for their lives, that they're right there with Pat
Hankler
actually doing it?
Absolutely.
Photographs, so he
wasn't
three quarters of the places they
give
him credit for, he wasn't ever there.
He's the one that did all the drawings. He has many books of drawings. Yeah, the great drawings. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I was going to add to that. Harper's Gazette, Harper's Weekly, you could use photographs. So what they do is they make a woodcut of a photograph and put that in the Harper's Weekly. So they're not necessarily there to make
a couple, 3 weeks after you're there.
Yes, Mr. Wenzel.
Sneddon's map of Ox Hill, Chantilly, is total fiction. Total fiction. There's nothing accurate in it at all.
Yes, anyway, yes, sir.
Ray, the location of Bienvenue, it's located pretty much in the center of McLean, or near the center of McLean, off Dolly Madison Boulevard, about a block in on Churchill Road. As far as Camp Pierpont, the headquarters was located in what was called the Langley Ordinary, and it's on 193, actually right behind the CIA.
Mm.
And there are signs that the county put there a couple of years ago about the Langley Ordinary, but there are no Civil War trails.
It definitely needs one, I believe, sir.
I'll go back there, check it.
Pierpont named for the guy who claimed to be governor of Virginia.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, Ed.
Mark, could you tell us maybe a little bit about the Confederate wounded being taken back to Frying Pan and Stewart's retrieval of his wounded the following day?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, that he got some assistance from the Georgia division, and somebody else came up from Centerville, and he was able to feel confident enough to go back to the battlefield, but the Federals had left. Some of the Southern soldiers had been administered to by some of as best they could by the Pennsylvania troops, and were left there. Maybe some were taken prisoner at that time, but he did was able to retrieve some and retrieve his dead and take them back. So he did not write of this as a defeat. He did not. He wrote of it as an action. Gave a lot of praise. Gave about two or three paragraphs of praise to a lot of people that like Forney. I forgot to mention, and I think I should have mentioned this earlier, but Kane, who was the friend of the Mormons, was actually shot in the mouth, the roof of his mouth, knocked out all of his teeth, and was wounded for the longest time, and suffered. That was a horrible wound, but he did survive that wound. So,
is he the one that commanded the gate on Cox Hill?
I don't believe so, but I double-check on that.
Because it's very interesting, too, the brigades that were fighting on Cox Hill were Candy and Kane.
Right. Candy, I do know because he defended Dumfries in the winter of 1862. Colonel Candy and Colonel Mustard and all that, you know, from the game. But now Colonel Candy did a fine job defending Dumfries against bombardment of the cavalry units of Jeb Stuart, where they just bypassed the town and kept going north. So, yes, Anybody else? Well, thank you for coming, and I don't know if there's any more cake. Thank you so much, ladies, for tonight. And
round table for being our speaker tonight.